Welcome to Footnotes, a legal podcast run by students, for students, breaking down the law and all its complexities, one chat at a time. I'm Justin, coming back to do the introduction once again. This episode is a continuation on our previous episode, and the second of two parts. The same guests are on: Jonathan Gaston, Maddie Smith, with Stan and myself hosting. Burnout remains the topic. We'll be chatting about ways to understand and tackle it. We'd highly recommend checking out the first episode as it contextualizes the conversation we're about to have.
Jonathan, in your presentation, you touched on the concept of emotional labor and how that plays into burnout. So would you be able to explain what exactly emotional labor is and how it actually plays into perhaps legal workspaces or just spaces in general?
Yeah, I'd really be happy to actually, because I think this idea of emotional labor is that the same as physical labor. What the research is showing is that emotional labor can create the same levels of fatigue and tiredness and so on. So that answered one question with a few of my cynical friends who'd say, but you just sit in a chair all day, like, why are you tired? Right? You know what I mean? So like, now I've got a way to explain it to them.
Yes.
Right? So I've been doing lots of emotional labor today, right? So get off my case. All right. So Hochschild in 1993 defined emotional labor as the management of feeling to create a publicly observable facial and body space. So this idea of self-presentation. So emotional laborers, really the key is what they have to do in their work is they have to spend a lot of time regulating these displays in that sense. Mm-hmm. So for example, emotional demands can include things like paying attention, maintaining a neutral tone, understanding clients' feelings, taking into account their needs, showing concern and empathy, and doing a lot of suppression of your own emotional responses in doing so. And they talk about this idea of emotional dissonance, which is simply that idea of how big is the difference between what I'm feeling internally and what I'm having to project outwards, right? And I love this term, and a lot of my clients have run with this. They call that surface acting. Right. So how much surface acting do I have to do in my job overall? But how much surface acting do I have to do right now? Like, it's like, you know, it's also like with this particular person, right? And so it's a lovely idea that of realizing that these certain professions, certain work roles, certain jobs require a lot of emotional labor. So I'd put the legal profession there. I'd put any sort of, again, helping or health profession. But let's also throw in, I mean, imagine working on the IT help desk, right? I mean, anything, retail, right? Yeah. So anything where you're having to present a fairly consistent outward version of yourself, despite what's going on for you internally, is going to use emotional labor. And that's been a really key thing with understanding burnout, right? Because one of the issues can be is that we don't have multiple, if you think about your emotional labor resources as just a finite sort of container, we don't have multiple ones for different facets of life. And this is a problem. So if I'm using a lot in my workplace, I may not have a lot left over for like the relationship or social aspect of my life. So now, no, I don't want to go out this weekend. I want to just get in front of Netflix and sit by myself, right? Does that make sense? Because any type of social interaction, to some extent, uses some emotional labor, even if it's, you know, not negative interaction. But, you know, I mean, any time we interact. And so that's why often, you know, and I explain this to my partner, that, like, when I come home and just want to sit down by myself for 20 minutes, you know, don't see that as rejection. I'm just having to put a bit more back into the emotional labor resource pot. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it's important to validate that, but it's also important to realize that, it, you know, work can really over-pull from that. Although, and also, what's going on in your life outside of work could be draining on those resources, and so you've got less available for work
definitely
than you normally would have. Is that okay? So I think this idea of emotional labour, and that some professions really are based on that being a lot of what you have to do, mm-hmm. is, I think, one of the key things I discovered, and it really all of a sudden made a lot more sense of burnout. And I had assumed that the legal profession, you know, in a lot of contexts, is an emotional labour rich, if we say, environment. But I then realised it's not just interaction. I had a client, they were required to sit in a Zoom meeting with an international group, but they weren't supposed to say anything.
Yeah.
So they basically had to sit for an hour and a half in this meeting every week, look interested, but actually not do anything. Can you imagine that? You know, when you're that bored and that sort of angry, does that make sense? So it was a nice example of they weren't interacting at all, but they were still using heaps of emotional labour because they had to present like they wanted to be there.
So in certain workplaces and environments, there feels like there's kind of a norm of, like, you know, cutting off your emotions or keeping a rein of yourself, what you talked about, Jonathan, in terms of surface acting, to either become or maintain some level of success. You're encouraged to thicken your skin because, like, that's the way it is. And any, you know, behavior that might be deemed like overly hysterical or histrionic or kind of like a bit like wayward in terms of emotionality is considered,
or human,
you know, you're considered to be losing it. You're considered to be someone who doesn't have a full scope of control over their situation. Is that a expectation which is dangerous, or to put it in some way, a necessary thing to have in a workplace?
Yeah, I think it is. It's dangerous in a cumulative sense. I think the research is pretty clear that emotional suppression doesn't usually lead to good outcomes. I'm not saying there's not a role for emotional suppression. For example, it often will prevent homicidal behavior, right? So, you know, in the moment, it's a coping strategy that you sometimes need. But as a constant way of dealing with things, I think the research is pretty clear. I don't know, my other hero is Brene Brown, and if you talk, you know, listen around vulnerability and stuff, and she, she's a much, definitely listen to her stuff if you haven't. And she's such an advocate for, look, you know, the pathway to good mental and physical health is actually emotional recognition. But yeah, you're right, but and I don't know. I still think that harden up, or whatever you call it, mindset seems to be, we talk about dominant cognitive cultures in professions, very embedded in medicine. I'm trying to think of clients I've worked with. Again, it's one of the most damaging things, I think, probably. I don't know. I'll let you guys know. I feel the research suggests it's one of the most damaging things because it can drive a lot of shame and self-criticism. Does that make sense? Which is completely unnecessary, and also can lead to, you know, obviously self-harm and all sorts of bad things. So so I'm not a great lover, as you would imagine, of emotional suppression, really, in a, it's an ongoing coping strategy.
No, of course not. And I think the same question for Maddie. You're in the actual legal field as well, and so am I. But do you think that toughening up in law is necessary, or is it dangerous?
What I've found is, if I'm ever having, if I'm ever at work and I feel like there's something that's intruding on my mind, it is the smartest strategy for me to help my employer by going to take a coffee break or going to a room for an hour and just like coping with that and calling a friend or finding, meditating or finding some kind of a coping strategy that allows me to recognize what I'm feeling, to address that, and then to kind of compose myself a bit more. That's a more authentic okayness for me to then proceed through the workplace during the day. Yeah.
People are actually employing a coping strategy when they say that.
Yes.
And that's the problem.
Yes.
With it. Rather than a you know, a manager or a supervisor or a mentor sitting you down and saying, look, you're going to have a lot of instances, vicarious traumatization, you know, overload. So you have to expect that. So normalizing, but then actually mentoring you in adaptive, does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Ways of coping. So I think the danger of that term is more about this is the way you cope.
That's right.
As opposed to, a lot of tough stuff comes up in our work.
Yeah.
But let's talk about ways to deal with that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely.
I worked for a barrister in the criminal defence space. You know, I would regularly deal with child sex assault matters, and that's tough. I was like, no, I need to understand, of course, that's going to be hard to read and heavy, and I need to take a minute to process this before I can do my best work.
And that's not weak. That's just human. And we should be, you know, praised for being human, not kind of diminished or devalued because of being human. And I think that's a huge thing with legal workspaces as well, is that they'll be like, you just need to toughen up, you need to thicken your skin, this is how it is. If you want to survive here, you have to toughen up. And I have been told that multiple times.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's awful.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. I wanted to actually move into the schema therapy stuff that I saw in Jonathan's presentation. Maddie and I actually bonded. we had schema match, literally. But we mentioned schema therapy together on Instagram before we actually met properly, which is now. So it's safe to say that we are quite passionate about this topic. So for those listening, would you be able to explain the concept of schemas?
In 2 minutes. look, probably the easiest way to see it, I think schema is just another word to think about our underlying belief systems, our core belief systems. And so Jeffrey Young, who was the founder of schema therapy, really put forward this idea, which made sense in terms of developmental psychology, that the things that happen to us, especially during childhood and adolescence, we're trying to work out who we are. So his idea was that the sort of influences, whether that's trauma, whether that's just modelling, parenting, you know, all the things that go into peer relationships, go into that phase of life, sort of set up these belief systems. And the problem can be that some of our experiences can set up what he would see as negative belief systems, what he calls schemas.
Yeah.
The problem then is because schemas operate at a fairly unconscious level most of the time, we carry those back into adulthood, and then the idea is they continue to create problems for us and often to set up self-fulfilling. How about I talk about psychology and then I'll let you.
Okay.
it is a running joke. If you don't have unrelenting standards, how did you go into the profession, right? Mm. So unrelenting standards is a schema that really talks a lot about setting very high and often unrealistic standards, perfectionism, that sort of thing, right? Yeah. So that, I think, is, and there's now, interesting, very recently, they've actually been doing research, doing schema measurement of people in graduate programs, which has been really interesting. So there's a nice project in the law, and actually confirming what we've always suspected, right? Yeah. So the one they've found pretty well across every student population in psychology is unrealistic standards.
Yeah.
The other one that's probably in psychology in particular that's most rife is what they call self-sacrifice. Mm-hmm. So this idea of a tendency to feel much more comfortable when you're meeting other people's needs, when you're focused on other people, suppressing your own preferences.
Yeah. Okay.
My viewpoint is schemas can sort of be a superpower and can be kryptonite, right? Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? So those schemas probably help us be good at what we do.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? Like, if you're good at self-sacrifice, you're subjugating your own needs, then your ability to listen and process and do a good assessment is better.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is we don't switch them off.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Okay. So I don't know. Again, that could be controversial, but I sort of think, look, you know, probably helps you be good. You know what I mean? Although there's limits to that. I mean, unrelenting standards can often, unchecked completely, you know, create problems in all study and all sorts of things. But but it's that ability to have insight into what your schemas are and to turn the switch off. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And so on. So
yeah, that's, I think, when you said like self-sacrifice, I was like, ouch. Jesus. That happens to me a lot. I'm very, you know, constantly being available for other people is a huge thing. So like constantly being a source of emotional or, you know, even like, you know, social academic support for other people, you know, not letting other people know that, you know, like not wanting to put a burden on other people, being sort of a sponge for any type of labor, you know, that's like a huge thing. You know, me and my many people that I know, all of their like lives are founded on like even that, but also like a fear of not want, the fear of like selfishness, a fear of feeling self-absorbed, a fear of being kind of, you know, isolated or like, you know, ostracized because of that selfishness, wanting people around you to love and care for you, you know, that sort of speaks in many ways to a deep insecurity that we all have, which is just people wanting, we want people to like us.
Yes.
And so we buy into self-sacrifice as a way of keeping people around us.
Yeah.
And then that leads, I think, from a social context to a lot of, you know, surface acting, wanting to feel okay for other people. It leads to a lot of, you know, emotional toll where, you know, you have no capacity to, you know, expound on your own feelings because you're so constantly devoted to caring for what other people say. So it's just, yeah, from a, like a social context. I'm not entirely sure how that plays into an academic context because, like, you know, I guess helping people out studying, but that's also like self-reflexive because that helps you. But yeah, definitely from like an interpersonal standpoint, that it's right. very.
So to tie, it's great to hear you turn it, and to tie it in, you can see then from an emotional labour point of view, where it gets problematic.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm going to work and using a lot of those skills, and then outside of work, I'm used, my container's not that full.
Yeah.
I'm constantly being this role for people, and or what happens over time is you accumulate needy people around you. So I just thought I'd tie it in with emotional labour. It's really nice way of saying that both could be contributing to sort of feeling at least emotionally exhausted, if not, not full burnout, but you know, it's like, oh.
I wanted to actually explain to some people maybe my experience with schema therapy so that people can understand how it can actually help you. And for example, for me, I was made to like fill out that quiz thing where you label different sort of scenarios with between 1 to 10, and then the therapist will kind of score it all up and then make a bit of like a graph, and at the top was unrelenting standards. So I think Maddie, you might have had the same one as well. So that, and then what my therapist did was link the first few, like the top schemas, and it was like a cycle. They fed into each other. Yeah. So unrelenting standards, but I was also very punitive on myself. So self-punitiveness. Mm-hmm. So when I didn't meet those unrelenting standards, I would punish myself and make myself feel bad about it. And then there was also another top one, which was lack of self-discipline. So they all fed into this really unhealthy cycle with each other. Maddie, if you are comfortable to share this, how has your understanding of your own schemas helped you with your own mental health?
I definitely feel what you're saying about the cycle that you can get into with schemas. And one thing that I would say as well at this point is how useful it is to see a psychologist or to use, you know, CAPS, counseling and psychological services that you said, to explore these ideas and to externally outsource that expertise so that you start beginning to develop an awareness of these things, because that's the key for me, is to be conscious of the ways in which I might be having unrelenting standards, or in which I might be self-sacrificing, or approval seeking was another one that I have. I play into that defectiveness schema too, that idea that like if I don't meet these unrelenting standards, the cycle for me is that there's something wrong with me that I need to try and, you know, fix. So yeah. I think having that exploration, and what you said as well about having time for yourself, where rather than distracting yourself with, you know, I'm guilty of the doom scroll on Instagram. Yeah. Like, you know, you just, before you know it, 30 minutes has passed and you have no idea what you've just looked at.
Yeah.
And instead to try and take some time to devote to myself and to exploring how I work. Like, it's a fun thing to know yourself.
Moving into a little bit more of solution-focused, with both of you as well, solution-focused discussion, do you have any advice for students who are feeling the anxieties of the academic year ahead, and whether they will secure the position they want after uni?
Yeah, I do. I have a lot of advice, actually, but the advice centers around being kind to yourself. I know that that is something that's thrown around constantly, but I really mean it. Like, I used to be a bit more punitive towards myself, and you know, when I didn't get the clerkship, or I actually didn't go for clerkships, but if I didn't get a role, rather than letting that feed into these reserves of self-doubt or self-hatred and going, God, I'm not good enough, and you know, I can't believe I didn't do that, like, instead going, hey, that's okay, like, you actually won't even remember these rejections in 5 years.
Yeah.
and no matter what, you will find your path, like, it's cliche, but you're not going to just be jobless forever. Like, there are infinite chances for new opportunities, and in fact, I always find that you end up in many ways being grateful for not getting plan A, and having to find a plan B or C. So having patience and faith in the process and in yourself, trust yourself, you know, you'll be able to get through. And, you know, academics can be a wild ride. You can choose to step back and see the forest for the trees, or you can get lost in it. So trying to just enjoy the craziness of it and see it as a journey that will work out at the end.
Yeah, and I think also the concept of scarcity, it really permeates into this industry. The idea that there isn't going to be a job for you, or like there isn't going to be the one that you really want. And I feel like we can all fall into that trap of feeling like the world is scarce and there's not going to be anything for us. I wanted to also ask, so how do you think students can regain motivation?
It is so easy to use the word self-care and to think that, oh, I can
have a bath.
Yeah, have a bath and then done. You know, whereas a concept we've been coming back to throughout the podcast has been, I think, the idea of an empty cup or a full cup, you know, and you're constantly emptying your cup in various ways throughout your life and pour back into it. And if you set up self-care routines, and that will look different for everybody, but practices that just help you to feel good about yourself, that you're not doing it for a higher purpose to achieve some kind of outcome or productivity, it's just for you, whatever truly makes you feel great. Then if you have those in place, you have a greater capacity to handle any crap that comes your way, and there will be crap. So I think there's that. And the other point I would make is to connect. You know, I think we all, especially in law school, we have this idea that everyone else has got their life together. Everyone else is perfect. No one else is really struggling that much. And reaching out and talking to people in law school, or just talking to your friends and family, or seeing a psych, or whatever it is that allows you to open up and to explore that vulnerability, that Brené Brown. Everyone go watch Brené Brown's TED Talk, like, if you haven't already.
Yeah, I really like the second point which you made, which is like connecting. I'll talk from a more sort of studying / student perspective here, which is this idea that a lot of people get like the anxiety that sets in when, like, you know, around their academic capabilities. So like, for example, most people constantly interrogate themselves on like, why did I pick law? In like, especially when like marks come out, or when they maybe don't do as well as they thought they would do on an assignment, or, you know, see other people's success in other areas.
And, well, they're not enjoying one of their first
exactly, jobs, you know, like, and they'll ask themselves, why did I pick law? At least from a kind of more approach to the like black letter stuff, I've always found that like integrating like mechanisms that make me happy within my approach to studies has been a really helpful way. So for example, like when I study, I try to study like in a group of people, with my surround myself with my friends. I've always found that, and I've always recognized this in myself, in that if I'm with other people trying to help like, you know, if I'm with a group of people trying to help each other, I retain that information better, because I've recognized that if I can tell someone something, it means that I've understood it and retained that information and can educate someone else on it. So I looked at the way that I studied and I recognized that it linked to an intrinsic part of my own personality, which was a want and need to help other people, something that you talked about, Maddie, as well. So I think that, you know, almost boiling it down to basics, finding ways to find yourself in tasks, you know, even like mechanizing things in a way which makes it so that you naturally enjoy it a bit more. Like, there is no mystery around study. Study is hard. There is no mystery around the path to a job. That's in many ways quite a reality check. But if you can, you know, try and find ways to make it better for yourself, like, there is in many ways no cookie cutter solution for anyone, but I think it is coming from a place of self-recognition. Even if it's not a be all end all, it's a nice way of approaching it. And if it makes you a bit happier, then I always find that that's still worth it. So then, do you have anything?
I wanted to ask Jonathan, from a psychological perspective, how can students listening start to implement consistent and healthy measures to avoid burnout? Just tying it back into this whole...
Yeah, of course. Look, I think it was really interesting to hear you guys talking about when you're asking yourself questions, because one of the things I think I talk to my clients about is asking questions is actually a good thing, but it's the way you're doing it. I think a lot of people ask themselves a question as a way to criticize themselves. So that it's not actually from a point of curiosity. Does that make sense? As Maddie's talked quite a bit about today, I think one of the things to be really aware of is our internal attribution about things, right? You know, so it's what have I done wrong and that sort of thing, and trying to step back and be more open to that, and say, look, I've got to look at what's happening outside as well, right? I've been playing around with the term, and I bet if I go Google, it's already been made up. But I'm calling it organizational gaslighting. Mm.
Ooh, that, I like that.
Because I think we are now understanding relational gaslighting, and I think there's a lot of stuff that goes on at outside of the individual to sort of manipulate a bit or to push people towards self-blame. Just like in relational gaslighting, right? Mm. So I think this idea, I suppose, of being sort of aware and to be smart, I suppose, about, look, I need to sit back, evaluate what's really going on, both inside myself, but also in other people. Work life, obviously study life balance. I mean, all those things go without saying.
Yeah.
We do know that social connection does buffer people from burnout.
Mm-hmm.
Having variety buffers people. So having other things you do outside of just study. So these are all things you can do at an individual level. Schema work.
Mm.
Jeffrey Young has written a book called Reinventing Your Life. If people want to just sort of have an introduction, it's written for people to, it's a sort of self-help book, so you can actually look at your, if you want to just look into your schemas without yet going to a psychologist, you can. But ultimately, as I said, like, remember, support's out there. If you can't get enough from your friends and family, go see someone, talk to someone.
Jonathan, Maddie, thank you so much for giving your time and advice to the podcast. It's been amazing listening to your thoughts and experiences and ideas on how, we all can improve ourselves. So, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
It's been an honor.